Thanks, Peter. Well, thank you for coming tonight. Peter's been at me for a long time to do this, and I've been putting it off for a long time, trying to think of a topic. As you said, what I'm not, and although I will touch on it and talk about it a bit, is I am not an archaeologist, or an anthropologist, or a geneticist even, or even a population biologist, although I will talk about those things or touch on those. I'm, you know, a plant molecular biologist, plant biotechnologist, that's what I was. So I've got some understanding of DNA, and as you'll see, it'll mostly be about the science of getting this data, and we'll finish up with talking about some of the things it tells us, and you might finish up having questions, and I'll attempt to answer those as well with this sort of thing. But of course, it's a topic that has interested me, which is why I've actually done it now. I should be able to just press this. Yep, okay. Because we're running a bit late, I'll have to watch the time. It's a fairly full program. I always pack a lot into my lectures, or try to. Much to the student's chagrin when I used to do it, but hopefully I won't go too fast, and hopefully I'll get through everything in a satisfactory manner. This is a sort of a bit of an outline of what I want to do, okay? Very briefly, the topic's there to go through it, human evolution and migration, just to set the scene a little bit, and then we'll sort of return to it a bit at the end. But I actually want to spend a bit of time talking about DNA. I don't know the background. If you do understand it and you know it all, I apologise. And if you don't and it's over your head, I apologise. Hopefully somewhere in there there's enough for you to get an inkling out of it. But I want to talk a little bit about human DNA and their mitochondrial DNA and why chromosome DNA, so that you might have some understanding when people do studies on this, why it is they draw these conclusions about human origins and human ancestors, that sort of thing. And of course it all became very popular with the publication. This is one of the books. This one, The Seven Daughters of Eve, in 2001, I think this one was, and then, or 2002, and this was in 2003 or 1 and 2. This one here, The Journey of Man, this is by Brian Sykes. He's an Englishman from Oxford University. This guy is from the United States. This one book is, and I'll come back to them maybe, and they're excellent books. They're a good read for the layperson. They're really good. This is about principally about mitochondrial DNA. This one's about Y chromosome DNA. There's a whole swag of books. There's Spencer Wells has now gone on to write, and there's just a lot of books out there. In the last 10 years, this whole field has sort of exploded, and I'll touch a bit on how that's come about and why that's come about. It's a bit to me as a biochemist, it's pretty incredible the progress that's been made. Okay, so here then is a pretty sort of quick and dirty picture of human relation, or our place in the sort of primate family tree, with this sort of thing. And again, the sort of thing you're all familiar with, we've got humans, and this is meant to be some sort of origins, and points of common ancestry, and there's a splitting away here with humans, and we've got chimpanzees. Our closest biological relatives are chimpanzees, at least based on a range of things, including DNA data. And other type, the bonobo here, and the great ape, and the orangutan, and sitting down here, this poor chap here, which I'll touch on, is Neanderthal man. He's fallen off the tree, okay, the branch break, you see here, presumably, and because they're extinct, and I'll touch a bit on that. But that's the sort of idea, the relationships, and the question is, I'm not going to address how we're related to these, to living organisms and so on, although the sort of information can in part be used to derive these connections, but I'm not specifically going to address that. It's more really within our own ancestry. Some of these pictures do we need to turn the light? Can you see that all right? I'm just not sure. Is it okay? So some of these are scans and all that sort of thing, and the picture quality varies, and it all pinks from the web, and that sort of, that various sort of thing. But here is, this one comes courtesy of Michael Knight. Thank you, Michael, for this particular one. This one, again, is a sort of a very deep sort of origins of humans, based primarily on fossil records and presumably archaeological sites, tool use and that type of thing, I guess would be true to say, I think, is that right, Michael? Primarily, going a long way back to, you know, 4 millions of years ago in this sort of thing, up through the human lineage to Homo habilis, Homo erectus, perhaps, and then Homo heidelbergensis, perhaps, with Homo sapiens, Neanderthal man. And interestingly, this little one sitting out over here, Homo floresiensis, is the fossils they found, you may have read it in the media a few years ago in Indonesia, the hobbit it got, you know, because they're very short. And I won't specifically touch on that because, in fact, there is no, there's fossil evidence and so on to talk about it. I mean, how related are they to, you know, where do they fit into this tree is a bit controversial. And with this sort of thing. Now, what I'm going to talk about really is right up here, DNA. Because DNA is a biological molecule, it doesn't hang around for too long, although the oldest DNA that's been sequenced is now up to about 60,000 years old, you know, where people have done studies on it. It's certainly not around, you know, when you're getting down these sorts, you know, a million years ago and those types of things. It just, at this stage anyway, just doesn't exist to be able to do anything about that. So I'm really just talking about what does this sort of information tell us about the origins of Homo sapiens. Because again, this is over a few hundred thousand years. yeah, simply because we don't have any, we have Homo erectus fossils, but there's no DNA in them, so you can't draw any conclusions there. But you can with Homo neanderthalensis, and you can with early humans. So far there's been no data published. It appears as though there's DNA in those floresiensis, but there's been nothing published, at least I haven't seen anything about that. I think people would be waiting with much interest if they are able to do that, that sort of thing. Okay, so that's the sort of background in which now, because now I'm going to go off and talk about DNA and how you then can use the DNA from living humans and then use it to infer these sorts of relationships. Or what relationships can you infer? Here's another one. Which is sort of the a slight variation. We've got habilis and erectus, and then a question of where that might come out, of course, and then Homo sapiens spreading out of Africa to Europe, Asia and America after Homo erectus moved out of Africa into Europe and into Asia. So it would appear from the fossil data and so on. But again, we're really only looking up in this region in terms of DNA. It really can't at this stage go any further back than that. Here's the evidence what's used. Not that I've used this, but just in picking it up, the sorts of things to infer human migration and, of course, human development origins and evolution, as it were. These are the sorts of things that are used for doing this. And of course, this is the new boy on the block. Genetic studies really only since probably the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. Although people have been known about DNA for a long time, the ability to work with it in the way that is useful for this sort of thing really didn't take off until the late 80s with that type of thing. So it's through the 90s, and what's happened in the last 10 years is really appears to me to be quite spectacular. Everybody's jumping on the bandwagon. It's a new area to try and get lots of research money and do things, or that sort of thing, and so people are. But it's right down here, but it's the new one because we couldn't get this sort of information previously, or not easily anyway. Okay, let me go change then. So we're all familiar with this. We're all composed of many cell types. With that, and all human cells contain DNA except mature red blood cells. That's not true of the red blood cells of other organisms. Some of them have DNA in them, but in humans they don't. So when you give blood and they're going to get DNA out of your blood, they're actually using the white cells, the antibody producing cells and so on in your blood, not the red cells, to get the DNA from. They have it. It's found in the nucleus. We're all familiar with that, I think, probably. But it's also found in a subcellular organelle called the mitochondrion, which you may or may not have been aware of. And when this was first discovered and first reported, it was greeted with a great deal of skepticism. The dogma, of course, is that, well, your genes, your DNA, was all found in the nucleus. And that got passed on to the next generation and so on through the gametes. And the idea that there was DNA somewhere else was a real, one of these sort of great moments in science, in a sense, for that sort of thing. In plants, the chloroplast, which is the subcellular organelle for photosynthesis, also has DNA. So plants have both mitochondrial DNA, chloroplast DNA, plus nuclear DNA. But in humans and in mammals, indeed in mammals, it's also located there. Okay, so a bit about DNA again. This is just over 50 years now since it was reported in the literature in 1953 by Watson and Crick. Everyone knows this sort of thing. And when you think about that, it's now nearly, not quite 60 years, and we didn't know what the structure of DNA was in 1953. Now, what we know now, again, is a spectacular increase in our ability, our understanding, and our ability to manipulate this molecule. I mean, in 1953, I started my Dow biochemical education in 1963, only 10 years after DNA was discovered, you know, and so it's extraordinary to see what's happened. Again, it's a deoxyribonucleic acid, an information-carrying molecule, which is coded in the sequence of these four chemical compounds, which are always abbreviated as A, T, G, and C, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. They're chemical compounds that are attached to a sugar phosphate backbone. Okay, and that's what the ribbon part is. It's a sugar, it's deoxyribose, and it's phosphoric acid. It's a long linear polymer of these two molecules. And then these bases, as they're called, because they're an organic base, chemically, are attached to one of the ribbons, like this, and they pair up, and you get this double twisted ladder or double helix. Again, we're all familiar with that, I think. These bases pair with one another. They are not chemically joined to one another here, but in the strands opposite one another, they are paired to one another. G with C and A with T, always. And that's the way they pair up. Okay? Now the information is in the order of these bases. It's read out three bases at a time. The code is a triplet, the genetic code is a triplet code. The information is read out three at a time. We don't need to know that. What we need to know though is that the order of these bases convey information. And where they're located in a piece of DNA also conveys information. The information is organised, and this is just a way to try and help people. Actually, it's a slide that I used to give to primary school students, so that's not a reflection of your abilities at all, that sort of thing. But if we want to think of the way it's organised, the nucleotide, which is what one of these bases is, these chemicals, or base, is a letter. A gene will be, say, the equivalent of a paragraph. It's an assemblage of letters, a variable number of letters. Some genes have got many letters, some have fewer letters. With that, in humans and mammals in particular, and or vertebrates, where the genetic information is organised into chromosomes, and so on, or most animals, of course, a chromosome might be a volume or a book of some sort there. And of course, the genome is the complete genetic material of an organism. It's called the genome. Is a set of volumes, if you like, because usually there's multiple chromosomes. And for the human genome, it was sequenced in, or it was completed in about 2000, got much too much fanfare and publicity. It's about 3.3 billion letters. Okay, long, it encodes for, and people weren't surprised at that. They were a bit shocked at this. Only 30,000 genes. It's a bit embarrassing. An earthworm's got 15,000, and we only got twice as many. That raised all sorts of issues about how you go from that low set of genes to the complexity of what we like to think of ourselves with only by, say, doubling the genes or something like that. And some organisms, of course, have got many more genes, although there's a lot of duplication. Plants, for example, may have many more. There's about 100,000 proteins, And of course the old dogma was one gene, one protein, and it doesn't work out here, but there are well understood reasons why that is so now, because proteins are often modified after they're made. They're made by, the one gene makes a lot of sort of what we might call basic protein molecule, and they get modified in different ways. Some genes can give rise to several different proteins by various biochemical processes, but not to worry too much about that. And we have 46 chromosomes, 23 pairs of chromosomes. You'll be familiar with that, and this varies amongst organisms as to the number there. You know, it's not necessarily unique. I'm not sure if there's another organism that has 46, but you know, that type of thing. If you look at chimpanzees, our closest relatives, chimpanzees have 48 chromosomes, 24 pairs, for example. So that's the idea. And of course, this doesn't include, when people talk about this sort of thing, the mitochondrial DNA. Now, it doesn't have a lot of information in it, but what it does have is fairly is potentially useful. Here's how it's organised, the human genome, one way. And I put this one up, not because there's a lot of information. I don't want you to take the information down. It's usually that it's 3 billion base pairs, or 3,000 megabases. 3 billion here. The interesting thing, and I won't say disturbing, but of course the thing that was a bit surprising, the actual coding region, or the genes and gene-related sequences, is only 900 megabases. Most of it is what we might call junk DNA. Now, that's not a good term, actually, but nevertheless, that's how it got described. Most of our DNA is not involved in making proteins and other things that are necessary to keep the cell, certainly the individual cell that contains those genes, because remember, they're the sort of blueprint, the recipe to manufacture things to keep the cell alive and the whole organism functioning and so on in a coordinated manner. With that sort of thing, with that, and so there's all of this extragenic DNA. It's not extraneous, although we don't really understand why there's so much of it there. It's full of all sorts of things. But some of the things that I'll touch on maybe later on is things like these tandemly repeated DNA, satellite DNA, microsatellite DNA, things like these signs. Single interspersed elements. These are probably long interspersed elements, and all sorts of things. DNA transposons are called jumping genes, and various things like that. The point is here is that this is the functional bit of the DNA, so far as we understand, and this doesn't seem to be functional. At least we don't really understand why. And there's a lot of repetition in here. There's long stretches of your DNA that are just simply the repetition of a triplet code. It might be an ATG, and it's repeated hundreds of times on a chromosome in that way. And we don't actually understand quite why that's so. But I may come back to that later. The organisation, there's one way I've talked about it. It's probably not right to talk about 4 types of DNA. It's all DNA, but I put it there with a question mark for that, because I hope by the end of the talk you'll understand why I've done this. So we've got autosomal chromosomes. In humans, we've got 23 pairs. We've actually got 22 pairs of autosomal chromosomes. Okay? We have an X chromosome, or depending on, there's an X chromosome and there's a Y chromosome. Okay, and I'll say a bit more about that in a moment, as you'll understand. And of course, these two are the sex chromosomes. These determine the gender of the organism in mammals. Okay, it's not necessarily the same as humans in lower animals. They have even platypus have a different way of a slightly different way of determining sex to what we're used to. Okay, in terms of the genetics. But for mammals and for humans, we're talking about, these are what determine sex. These two, and the autosomal of the other 22 pairs, and this makes up a potential pair, as we'll see. These are in the cell nucleus, and of course we've got the mitochondrial DNA here. And I've separated them out from that because you'll see why I've drawn that distinction, hopefully, later on. Here it is, jumping ahead of myself.
22 pairs of autosomal chromosomes. They're usually numbered 1 to 22. People can take, cells and isolate the chromosomes carefully and pair them all up and do all this sort of type of work. And they're actually numbered from 1 to 22. Basically, it's based on size. The biggest one's called number 1 and the smallest pair of autosomal is called number 22. These pictures here are, of course, false colour images. They don't look like this when you look at them. The DNA has been stained. Then there's a dye attached to, or they've been probed based on the sequence that might be in there. And then there's a dye attached to the probe, which can be visualised by using a laser, shining a laser, there fluorescent dyes. The thing I want you to see about this, they're paired up here, and you'll notice that the tops of the the colours are sort of parallel down the two sets of chromosomes, each of these chromosomes here. What that really reflects is that, of course, the genetic material, or the genetic information on one chromosome, is in principle the same as on the other. Right? Now, when I say in principle, there's a certain number of genes along chromosome number one, and the gene up here might be responsible for a particular function. And over here, the same gene is here, also responsible for the same function. And so on as you go through it. That way. Each chromosome, it's one long DNA molecule. Okay? So the DNA starts at one end, and if you could pull it all apart, it would be very long. Right? That sort of thing. And it's just a single molecule. Right? The DNA from one end to the other. We've got two copies of each gene on the autosomal chromosomes, one on each of the pairs. So if you looked at the genes along this one, which geneticists can do, not all of them, they don't know where all are located yet, but if you look at them, there's a matching one on the other chromosome. Of course, the reason why that is so is that one of those chromosomes you got from your mother and the other chromosome you got from your father. Okay, so each child inherits one of each autosomal chromosome from the mother and another one of each autosomal chromosome from the father. So there's 22 autosomals, 22 from mum, 22 from dad, gives you 44 chromosomes for 22 pairs. Okay, that's the inheritance here. Now, females, of course, the other two chromosomes, the X and the Y, what determines sex, or the gender, I should say, and what determines gender. And females receive an X from their father and an X from their mother, 1+1, another pair, in this way here. And males receive an X from their mother and a Y from their father, 1+1 in pair, so there's another pair. So we've got 44 chromosomes here, plus 2 is 46, so 23 pairs for females, except they've got two X's. And remember, males have an X and a Y. And that says that the developing embryo will develop into a male. Okay, with this sort of thing. Now, this is just meant to illustrate it. There's a process, and I'll come back to this. We'll see another slide later on. In the formation of the gametes, the sex cells, the egg and the sperm, of course, you can't unite an egg and a sperm when each have got 23 pairs of chromosomes. You've got to halve the chromosomes, so when they both come together, you get the correct number, you get the right number. That's sort of how it works, as it were. So the process whereby in the testes and in the ovary, the testes in males, the ovary in females, of course, where you produce the gametes, or the sex cells, you get this process that's called meiosis, where you get a reduction. I think the next slide will show it. But you get the N, which is the haploid number, the half number, only 23 single chromosomes in here, in each one of these, and 23 in the sperm. So when you get fertilisation and get the formation of the zygote, you've got 23 plus 23, which is 20, you get the 23 pairs, 46. And you get an individual, new individual form, grows, and so on. Now, this is slightly hard. I found it hard to find a really good picture of this, but we'll see.
Meiosis is the reductive division of in which the number of chromosomes per cell is cut in half. This is the diploid germ cell with four chromosomes. Imagine this is a cell with four chromosomes. Here are the two pairs. There's one here and one here. Remember, just looking at the size, although they're paired up like this, I think it's a bit misleading that way. It's the two small, the small white and small red, and the big white and the big red. Right, they're the sort of two pairs, the four chromosomes there. And you go through this process of meiosis, and you finish up with, from one cell, four daughter cells, which of course only have one big one and one little one, as you can see here. Okay, so that's the process, and of course these then, this happens in, this is exactly the same basically, whether it's sperm or egg. Okay, the same sort of thing happens, and then in fertilisation, they reunite to give you the full number. But there's one other thing that happens, and this is with the autosomal chromosomes, and this is, not that it's important, well it is, as you'll see later on, it's more important for what this is, and with the Y chromosome, what it's not. Okay. In this process of meiosis, you get this other process called recombination. And the like chromosomes, the paired chromosomes here, here's one here and one here, and this would have come from the mother and the father of this individual, if we imagine that's a person or something like that. This would have come from the mother and the father of that individual to make them a mixture of both, right? Now you'll notice here in this process that there has been some swapping. There's physical exchange of genes resulting in new combinations of DNA within each chromosome. So we get a swap. Just don't worry too much about the splitting here. This is not the pairing. Each one of these splits in two to give chromatids and so on. And that's how you finish up with having four, of course, over here, because these split in two and those two then separate yet again. Okay? But the point here is that you get recombination or chromosomal crossover, and so these genes here, which might be yours or your parents, when you come along or your children come along, you'll see that you don't necessarily, if these then recombine, you get this egg or sperm, and there's this one and this one, and then they'll pair up with the one from the partner. It's a completely different combination. Right, you see, because what's happened here, this chromosome here, which might have started out as this one here, suddenly picked up a bit of DNA. This might have come from the father, this has come from the mother of this person, and suddenly here's this one, which has actually got a bit of both in it. Okay, and so you get this mixing. Now that produces genetic diversity. Geneticists and evolutionists argue it produces the diversity that drives evolution in terms you might get sort of good attributes. And of course it's part of the reason why every one of us, in a sense, is completely different. We're different to our parents, and our children are different to us, and so on, because there's a mixing, not only just because your chromosomes came from your mother and your father, but your mother and your father's chromosomes danced with one another, did a bit of swapping, and then you got some random assortment came out of that, which made you in that particular way. So this is important, in a sense, as you'll see later, because what this does, it really mixes the DNA up, and it makes it actually very hard to use this DNA, or relatively hard to use this sort of chromosomal, autosomal DNA to track genetic lineages. Because they're just mixed up. Every generation that just gets scrambled a bit more, then the next one scrambled again. There's changes, because it gets mixed and gets very hard to follow. Mind you, you can do it now, such is the power of the technology, but in a sort of a special set of circumstances. Here's the Y chromosome. How to deal with that? Because the thing about the Y chromosome is that and I put up some data for the X chromosome. Although we call them a pair, the X and the Y, I think that's a bit of a misnomer. Unfortunately, the Y chromosome is a bit of a runt of a chromosome. There's not much of it there. Okay? The Y chromosome is about 58 million base pairs, and the X chromosome is more than 153 million. The X chromosome is pretty big. It's not the smallest chromosome out of all the others. It's bigger than quite a few of the other 22 autosomals. It's bigger than that. So these are the comparisons. It's got about 86 genes, and the X chromosome's got about 2,000 genes. One gene, which is called FRY, and it's got a variety of these genes, but this is the key one. This is the key one. This triggers testis development and hence maleness. It sits up here near one end of the Y chromosome. It's an important gene. The presence of that is what makes you a male. If it's mutated, damaged, or anything like that, you won't get a male fetus developing. It won't be male. It triggers the process, right? It's not the only gene involved in the process, but it triggers testis development, and of course that then results in the synthesis of testosterone and other changes that produce changes in other cells in the body, and the way the cells develop, and so on, and the organism you get. So it's got 23 distinct proteins. Now this is where you have to start. You may already know this, of course, but this is something we've got to now remember as we go through it. Since only males contain a Y chromosome, it is only inherited through the paternal line. You get your Y chromosome from your father. Your father got it from his father, and so on. Right. So your paternal grandfather, you have the same Y chromosome, potentially the same Y chromosome as him. Your maternal grandfather, no, you don't have it, right? You got it from your father. Although your maternal grandfather contributed some genes to you, quite a few, autosomal, the 22 autosomal genes. Somewhere in there you've got genes from your maternal grandfather, but not the Y chromosome from him. And it's inherited only through the paternal line. This is the other important thing about it. Although you often see it paired with the X chromosome, that's really just a convenience. It's not really a pair with it. It's a distinct chromosome, separate by itself. It does not recombine. The Y chromosome and the X chromosome do not exchange, under normal circumstances, genetic material. Now that's important because the Y chromosome doesn't exchange genetic material, and is passed down from father to son to father to son. That means the Y chromosome is, in theory, the one you've got is identical to your great-grandfather, your great-great-grandfather, and going back, in theory, potentially going back thousands of generations. It's exactly the same through that maternal line. Okay? If you don't have any sons, your little branch of it stops. Now, that's not to say it might be somewhere else. You've got a brother, you've got an uncle, potentially, you know, of your brother or of your father or something like that. It doesn't mean to say that's the end of it, but your little contribution to producing it doesn't. If you've got all daughters, it's different. So, this is the thing here, and this is the critical thing, and this is why the Y chromosome has been useful for this sort of thing. Now, it's not actually true to say that your Y chromosome is the same as 500 generations ago, because, as I'll come to it, there are mutations, there are changes in the DNA, and this is what we track, and this is what gives us the information. But this, the critical thing is that it's only inherited through the paternal line, and it's unable to recombine under normal circumstances, so you don't get any mixing. It's just passed down intact. In principle, it's passed down intact from generation to generation. Okay, let's just switch to the mitochondrial DNA at this moment, okay? Human mitochondrial DNA. So here's the structure of a mitochondrion. It's a little subcellular organelle, variable number and shape per cell, depends on the tissue, that sort of thing. Similar in size to bacteria, they're pretty small. I sort of tried to find some sizes. They're about half to one micrometers wide, but they vary in length. It depends on the tissue, so it's a bit unhelpful to say, I guess. It's got a double membrane cell. The important thing about them here is, I think I've eliminated the next slide, so they're the powerhouse of the cell. You'll see them called all sorts of things: the powerhouse of the cell, the energy generating part of the cell, the battery of the cell, or anything like this. They're crucially important. This is where we produce this molecule ATP from food molecules through biochemistry, This is one students doing biochemistry in second year at any university that teaches biochem. Get oodles. These are all these metabolic pathways, these chemical transformations that they groan and moan about having to learn. You know, how do you go from glucose and proteins and fat? You probably got it last, you know, this year in cell biology, did you? You know, how do you get to that, to get to this molecule of ATP? Because this is what drives cellular processes. You know, muscle can, oh, everything, muscle control, whole range of things. The functioning of the brain is dependent on producing this molecule to keep nerves functioning and muscle, and your muscles and everything. And these reactions require oxygen, which is why we need oxygen while we're air breathing. So it's an important organelle. It looks like this, and it all takes place. Most of the biochemistry takes place in this inner cavity here, which is called the matrix. The folding is actually due to increase the surface area of another important component of it, which is actually found in the membranes, embedded in the membrane. And the folding increases the surface area, increases the capacity. The development of aerobic respiration, as it's called, by presumably primitive cells in the evolution of life on the planet, was an enormous step forward in terms of energy efficiency and the ability to do that. We're all aware of how much energy food stores, because everyone who's tried to lose weight will realise that it's very hard. There's a lot of energy packed into a, you know, a fat molecule or a sugar molecule or something. It's easy to put it on, but it's very hard to get it off, because, you know, it takes a fair bit to do it. So it's an important organelle. But of course, I did leave it in. Sorry there, we'll skip over that. That's the biochemistry. I won't show you that. It contains this DNA. A great shock when people first found it. It doesn't have much. But what it does have is important for our well-being. Okay, here's just some figures. Remember, in the nuclear DNA, there's about 3 billion bases. In the mitochondria, there's 16,500. It's a lot smaller. Also, it's double-stranded, it's a twisted ladder, but it's closed into a loop. The ends attach to one another. It's a closed circle of the two. So it's a circular, double-stranded circular loop, exactly the same as in bacteria. That's how bacterial DNA. They're so-called chromosomal. They don't have chromosomes, but they're so-called chromosomal. There's 13 protein genes. There's a couple of other genes, what we call ribosomal RNA genes and transfer RNA genes, which are involved. These are actually involved in the process of protein synthesis. And is a part of the machinery of synthesizing the proteins from the protein genes with this. The genes for the synthesis of some of the protein components of what's called the electron transport chain, which is the respiratory chain, which is the process, part of that process of getting energy out of food. Okay, they're just enzymes that are just involved in that process. And these are just, don't worry too much about them, they're just scattered around this circle. They're different genes. They stand for something, cytochrome B, cytochrome oxidase, 1 and 2, this is the ATP synthesizing enzyme down here, and all that. Well, part of it. They're just part of it. Most of the mitochondrial proteins are actually encoded by nuclear genes. There are 1,500 proteins required to put together a mitochondria, and we've only got 13 of them made in the mitochondria. All the rest of the things have to be imported. What I want you to, the critical thing just to think about here, right up here is this little area here called, it's called HRV 1 and 2 in this particular diagram. It's got several different names. It's the replication control region, or the HRV region, which stands for hypervariable region, or the D loop. Okay, they're all the same, mean the same thing. This is the little thing that actually controls, or the part that controls the replication or the copying of this little piece of DNA. Okay, remember, you make new mitochondria in your cells, and they have to make copies of their DNA and so on, so they can, they basically, you make extra mitochondria by binary fission, just exactly like bacteria reproduce. You just get one mitochondria and it splits into two. You know, undergoes some changes to do that, and then goes into two. And you've got to duplicate the DNA so that some can go to each of the daughter mitochondria. In that sense. So this control region is important for that process. But it doesn't encode a gene as such as these other areas here. It's about 1,200 base pairs.
controls DNA and RNA synthesis. We'll come to this a little bit later. Mutations, there's a slide about mutations, that sort of later. But, of course, as we'll see, all DNA is subject to mutation, a mutational change. We don't want too many changes, for our DNA won't work and we won't survive. So there are very sophisticated repair mechanisms, and even mechanisms that actually check that it's correct. Proofreading is actually the name given to it. Actually, like when you go and check your manuscript or something you've written, and you scan it for mistakes and so on, we've got the biochemical processes that once DNA has been synthesized, it goes and actually checks that it's been done correctly and so on. That sort of thing. But in mitochondria, it's not terribly good at doing this sort of thing. The repair mechanisms are not as good as in the nucleus, and so you get a few more mutations. But we'll come to that later. We're going to time, so what's the time? Okay, now here's the other thing then that's interesting. And again, now you'll see why we're going to talk about why chromosome DNA and mitochondrial DNA. Because the mitochondrial DNA is the female equivalent, in a sense, of the Y chromosome, or at least the genetic transmission. Mitochondrial DNA is only inherited through the maternal line. Your mitochondria in your body, and all the cells in your body, came from your mother. Dad missed out. Sorry, you know, whether you're male or female. If you're male, of course, you've got the Y chromosome from dad. If you're female, you didn't get the Y chromosome. You've got two X's, one from mum and one from dad. The mitochondrial DNA only comes through the maternal line. No sperm mitochondria. There are mitochondria in the sperm, but they're all located just here at the base. This is the base of the tail. This is the tip of the tail, or the base, if you like, of the head. All the mitochondria are here, and their purpose is to provide energy, ATP, for the flagella to flash, you know, whip about to drive the sperm. It really is a propelling mechanism, okay? And it's to create ATP for this process here, so it's all located up here, most of it, and there's virtually none, if any, here. And this is where the nucleus is. This is where this haploid nucleus is, half the number of chromosomes, remember, because it's going to unite with the egg, hopefully. In fertilisation, and I've pinched this from Larson, these little cartoons. I like Larson cartoons. With that sort of thing, you get fertilisation. So the large egg might have 100,000 mitochondria. It's very much bigger than the sperm, and the tiny sperm may only have a few, and they're all concentrated here. So even physically, there's very little chance of any of these mitochondria actually getting into the egg, and if they do, they're certainly likely to get swamped out. But it's also been recently discovered that there appear to be specific biochemical mechanisms which will destroy male mitochondria, or mitochondria that have come from the sperm, if they get into the egg. So we get this conclusion then, like the Y chromosome, mitochondrial DNA is inherited intact, because you can't have any recombination here. There's no other DNA to swap with, as it were, in the mitochondria. It's just the mitochondrial DNA. So remember, in the autosomal chromosomes, they can swap with one another. The two X's in a female can swap with one another, because they're the same. They're the same. Well, one from mum and one from dad. The Y chromosome can't. There's not enough match with anything else to do that, and nor can the mitochondria. So we get mitochondrial DNA inherited intact over thousands of generations. So we've set the scene now for, here's a way to trace paternal lineage and maternal lineage. Right? Because if we look at your mitochondrial DNA, and if we look at the sequence of part, in fact what's actually used, or what was initially used, was this part, which the sequence is to work out, because it's only 1200 base pairs and you don't even need to do the whole lot of it. It's just come down from your mother, your grandmother, your great-grandmother, your great-great-grandmother, and so on. Okay, all the way back up. Now, so this is a diagram that attempts to... Sorry, a couple of diagrams that attempts to summarise this. It's a bit small, and if we just look here, and this is pinched off the web, there's a lot of stuff on the web, too much stuff on the web, actually. Yeah, a lot of it's pretty good, some of it... We came across a lot of interesting stuff, I thought. But anyway, but here's a picture. These are the autosomal chromosomes. Let's consider these as the
the 22, and if you're a female, they'll be the X chromosomes as well, the two X chromosomes, right? These are the autosomals here, and of course this is just meant to be a little picture, remember? If we come down to someone here, but if we just look at a great-grandfather and then their child here, you'll see he's got one from mum and one from dad, which is what happens here in this, and then this person here, this is idealised, and this person, this woman here, one from mum and one from dad, and of course then they have a child, a male child, and so on. Now this is meant to represent, this is the recombination, and so you get this swapping over. So if this is the state at the beginning, and of course it wouldn't look like that, but for purposes here, you know, this is they're like this. When you get down, this is one, two, three generations here, we get quite a mosaic of different genes that have crossed over. You know, and you'd have to say, ooh, gee, you know, you look along any one of these chromosomes, and actually these match up and they should be a little more different, I thought. But you might argue, this bit might have come from this person up, see, this bit's come from up here, this little bit here has come from over here or here, depending on how you read the colour, and so on. So all of these people have contributed some DNA to this particular brother and sister here. On their, see, and the problem there is, of course, if we looked at, you know, their DNA here and tried to infer some sort of lineage from that, it's extraordinarily difficult. Remember, these people are now dead and gone, sort of thing. We don't have any DNA from them to sort of have to look at them. They're, you know, so it is quite hard, though it can be done now, and because of the junk DNA. Because the junk DNA does actually get transferred, but we'll come to that. But I just want to say here, if you're just looking at this bit, it gets difficult. So that's the other chromosomes, and then I think the next slide shows the next two. Here's the Y chromosome, that's the little one down here, right? And then you see the little circle is the mitochondrial DNA. Okay, so here's the, shall we say, the same sort of image here. And you'll notice here, of course, that of course, depending on whether it's a male or a female that's produced, you'll see here that you get this sort of lineage down here. And so after one, two, three generations here, of course, there is only one mitochondrial DNA represented. Yet, we started off with one, two, three, four females at the beginning, but only one mitochondrial DNA lineage is left. All the others at this stage, you wouldn't say they've stopped because well, here they would have, but this woman, you know, here or up here, the grandmother might have had sisters and they had girls as well and so on. So it's not that it's that, but it's this unchanged. And the same with the Y chromosome. So the DNA in these two things here are identical to their great-grandparents, but not all the bulk of their nuclear DNA, the autosomal stuff, or at least the bits that recombine. Okay, so that's just sort of setting it up. Just a few slides on working with the DNA, just to illustrate it. All of this is, remember, only 50 years ago, you know, you were flat out getting DNA. You know, 30 years ago, it was still a struggle, and I'll give you an example of how it was, and so on. I mean, in the mid-1980s, there was a major... In the 1970s, there was a bit of progress. 1980s, there was another major piece of progress. And then into the 90s, there was yet more progress in the technology of it, and it's accelerated ever since, although mostly it's just been putting a lot of money in. So I'll look at it under these sort of topics. There's actually a couple of topics here I left off this one. Isolation, the purification, amplification of it, and the sequencing of it, okay, and then actually the analysis of the data, which is not what's there, but it will come up. Isolation, very quickly, it is very simple to isolate some DNA, certainly mitochondrial DNA, from you or I. That's easy. Just get a cotton swab, run it around your cheeks, stick it in a sterile tube and all that sort of, make sure it's sterile, do it, put it in there, and there'll be more than enough DNA to look at your mitochondrial DNA and probably your Y chromosome DNA as well. Okay? Such is the power of the technology these days with that sort of thing. Okay, so it's very easy with that. Of course, when you're getting into fossilized tissue, tissue that's been around, and we're talking, and even here we can be talking about forensic applications, just simply bodies, dead bodies that have been around for fairly recent times and all that sort of thing, or all those things. Of course, that's much more challenging, you know, to get it from bones and teeth, particularly ancient bones and teeth. I mean, it's hard enough getting it from current bones and teeth, anyway. It's much more difficult. But it can be done. People have worked out, they've perfected the technology and so on. Teeth are particularly good because the inside, the pulp in here, can be reasonably well protected and preserved, depending on the environment in which the organism has been sort of kept and so on, with that sort of thing. But by and large, DNA still doesn't survive, as I said, probably more than 50,000 years at this stage. That's the oldest that we've got. So isolation, it needs to be purified. And if you're, and the real problem with doing this, if you want to use it for these sorts of studies, any sort of study, forensic studies, all these sort of things, you've got to make sure that the DNA you're working with is the DNA of the target organism you actually got the specimen from. So you've got to watch for contamination. Okay, that's particularly, and so you get all sorts of setups like this. They wear gloves and all this sort of thing, probably even a face mask, the critical stuff. And this is in a, probably a, this is a laminar flow cabinet, which actually is a sterile environment with air blowing towards the operator to stop things coming in from outside. I mean, because we can actually work with such small amounts of DNA, if you're analysing someone else's DNA and a few skin cells of yours fall into the container, you'll analyse both of them. When you've got an awful mess, you'll be pretty able to work out what's going on because you've got a mixture of DNAs. It is acutely, exquisitely sensitive these days to being able to work with it. So you get a bit of DNA. You wouldn't normally get something like this if you were doing it from a fossil or something. This looks like, this is a very generous amount. You'd be over the moon if you got that much DNA out of doing an isolation. This is what's made the difference. This process of amplification using what's called the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, and you may see that around in the media and so on, and that. Invented in the mid-1980s, and for which the guy won the Nobel Prize 10 years later. Okay, it's a pretty quick winning of the Nobel Prize after your discovery with that sort of thing. It has totally revolutionised molecular biology and manipulation of DNA. You cannot overestimate the impact that this had on the ability of scientists to work with DNA. Because what it is, it's an amplification. It's a multiplication of a targeted segment of DNA. Let's say we start off with a piece that we've isolated and purified some DNA. This is our template DNA. We don't want to actually, and we've only got a tiny amount. You could have as small as a single molecule, double-stranded, a small piece of single strand, one molecule or one portion of a piece of DNA. That's double-stranded here. You know, normally it's not quite as, even though a tiny amount of DNA, it's probably still many copies of the piece of DNA you've got there. You can do it from a single piece. Basically, you start off with this template, and in a process of cycling here, and this is, I haven't used any slides to show you what goes on here. Basically, and you doubles after the first cycle, goes up, doubles again, you get this exponential amplification. So, by the 35th cycle, 2 to the 36th, you start with one piece of this DNA, and this is the target, so you're actually going to amplify only this bit. And that's done by choosing what they call, you know, setting up the conditions right, and so on, okay? And exploiting this ability of DNA has a specific sequence. And you can actually, you amplify just this region. And we won't go into how that's done. The point is here, of course, after 36 cycles, you've got 68 billion copies. So you don't need very much of this before you've actually got a measurable amount of that. And you can see it. And the point is, you say, this whole process here takes, from going from here to the end, probably 2 to 3 hours to do it. Alright? I mean, it's done automatically. You set it up, you put it in the machine, in a little tube, you take the tube out. Usually you do it overnight because you just want to go home and see, you think you're working then. You can add that, say, oh, how many hours a week you've been working? Oh, well, I had the PCR going overnight, so there's a few hours I can tack on. Alright, you come in the next day and you can work with it. But it's extraordinary with this sort of thing. So, of course, you don't need very much DNA from a fossil or from some exterior source, and you've got enough to then work with. So you've got this DNA. Here's an example on the mitochondrial DNA. This is a common region that is actually used, is the control region, as I said. You design, what we call the primers, and these are the things that actually tell this polymerase chain reaction to only amplify, as it were, between the primers. You've got a piece of DNA, you've got a primer here and a primer here, and it only amplifies what's in between the two. That's what gets copied over and over again. In this case, it's nucleotide 15,971 to nucleotide 16,411, which is 450 base pairs only. You do an overnight run, and here is your DNA. And this, you know, would have been, you wouldn't have even been able to see this bit of mitochondrial DNA, anything like that, tiny bit of it. And then here you've got enough to do a whole lot of stuff on. You could do this in second year biochemistry. In fact, you do this sort of thing in second year biochem now. Okay, with that sort of thing, you can do these sorts of things. Fairly easy to do it. And this is now amplified. For this, these might be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different individuals. Right? And you've now amplified the mitochondrial, this region of their mitochondria, here. Then you sequence it. Now, that looks a bit messy. Even this has been automated. Take that piece of mitochondrial DNA, an appropriate amount, put in the right mixture of things, put in a little tube, shove it in a machine, leave it overnight, come back the next morning, and the sequence of that DNA, the 450 base pairs, the order of those letters, A, T, G, and C, the order of them, is there sitting on a computer screen for you to look at. Overnight, actually. Yeah, well, maybe it's faster than that now. It used to be overnight when I was doing it, my students were doing it. Now it's probably a bit, So we get to sequencing. So it's feasible now. 9 o'clock in the morning, you turn up, get a mouth swab, right, of your thing, come back the next day at 9 o'clock, and they can tell you what your mitochondrial DNA is, sequences in that little region. 24 hours. In the mid-1970s, in the biochem school, it was still called that then, in the mid-1970s and the early 80s, that was a whole PhD to sequence that 450 base pairs. Someone got a PhD for doing that. Now the technician does, I think the machine takes 36 overnight. Right? It is extraordinary. Now, of course, this is the only way that we could sequence 3 billion letters in the human genome, in part, was it's highly automated. Hundreds of these machines doing this sort of thing to do it. Okay, so you get this sequence. Don't worry too much. Basically, these actually represent they're red, and they tell you the letters. And I won't go into how it's done. It's a particular device that does it, and there's computers. It's all controlled by the computer and so on. But it basically is an automated process. Of course, the next thing is it's all very well to have a whole lot of sequences, and then the analysis of the data becomes part of the issue. This is just a bit of a thing. Let's say this might be 450 here, I'm not sure. Here's a sequence of individual A, here's a sequence of individual B for the same region of DNA. Can you spot the difference? It's a bit of a challenge. And again, in the mid-70s, this is what we had to do. We had to do it by eye. It was pretty tedious. Now, of course, you stick it in a computer program, right? And it will go along and it'll compare all these. It'll start here and look at this one with it, and it'll do the comparisons with it. So, of course, if you put them together, here it is here. There's a difference. pretty hard to see that. Well, it's not, you know, it's very hard to see that when you sort of look at it there, but there's been a swap. And this is just a little thing that was off the web, just a different screenshot off the web, I think. And of course, you've got a swap here. Here's a G, guanine, which is now a mutation has occurred, or a difference has occurred, and it's now gone to an A, or maybe it's an A gone to a G. You just, you know, you don't know that, you just simply know they're different. So this is individual A, and the other one is individual B, for example. They're different. Not much of a difference, but they're different. And of course, as it says here, there's about, not many, 50 random single point changes that distinguish a child's DNA from their parents. We don't want too many mutations. Our DNA doesn't work if we've got too many. So it's remarkably good, but there are some differences. And as long as they're not in regions that are important, this is when they become too useful for identification and lineage tracking and so on. So you've got to line them, that sort of thing. And then ultimately, of course, you have to analyse the data. That's all done with computer algorithms and statistical analysis, of which I know nothing about. All we ever did, or my students did, is you entered the data into a computer program and it did all, punched all the numbers and did all the stuff, and sometimes it takes overnight because you're only using a little desktop computer. Mind you, it would have been a much bigger computer in the 70s, you know. And then you come out with things like phylogenetic trees, you know, which talk about the relatedness and of these things to one another, okay? But it's really the parallel development of all this technology that gives you the capacity to generate the data in a meaningful, in a real-time type situation so that it becomes meaningful. A couple of things need to talk about briefly again, because these become important then as we track the changes. Because if, just to jump ahead, if we look at the mitochondrial DNA in all of us and the Y chromosome DNA in all the males in the room, there will be differences between them, okay? There will be some differences. There won't be many, I would suspect, okay? Since we're probably having a quick look, we're all mostly Caucasian, of Caucasian origin. We probably are remarkably similar to one another, okay, in respect of Y chromosome. And indeed, the mitochondrial chromosome, but I'll come to that. But nevertheless, there will be some differences potentially. So we've got mutations. There are changes in genetic sequence. There are lots of things that, of course, you'll all be familiar with the sort of external ones like radiation and mutagenic carcinogens and those sorts of things that, of course, can damage DNA and cause all sorts of complications. But the other one, of course, is that really just simply errors that occur during meiosis, when you're generating the sex cell, or in DNA replication, even within the autosomal chromosomes and so on. Okay, this whole process, you can get errors occurring. The system is not perfect. It's pretty good, works pretty well, but it's not 100% perfect. Mistakes do occur. If these mutations occur in the germline, the gametes, then of course they'll be inherited. I mean, if there's a mutation by a chemical carcinogen in your liver cells or something, there's a good chance you may get liver cancer or something like that if it causes it, but you're not going to pass that mutation onto your children or anything like that, okay? That's in a somatic cell, a body cell, not in the germline cell. But if there's a mutation in sperm, and remember males produce sperm for a long period of their life, all the time there's a potential there, whereas females, the eggs are made in embryonic development, they're laid down then, and so there could be changes occur then. There's much more limited time when they could occur in females, but you can't do that. So you get, but they'll be inherited. Now the other thing that's important, because this is what's actually used now to track the relatedness of us using Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA, and that's to use a marker, what they call a marker. Now a marker is simply a mutation, but it's usually a mutation that does not deleterious or doesn't have any effect. It sits there, it's benign, I suppose, is one way to look at it, although we can't be sure of that, but it still sits there and it seems to be stably inherited with that sort of. So it's a DNA sequence with a known location on a chromosome or the mitochondrial DNA that could be used to identify individuals or species. So if we took that little 450 base pair of mitochondrial DNA and we sequenced it for everybody in this room, start at one end, okay, because there is an end to DNA, there's the so-called 5' end and the 3' end, so you can identify an end. You can count in and say, right, you know, we'll look through and we'll look at the 50th base, and what is it for everybody? Are we all the same, or is some of us different? You know, you look at the first, you look at the second, you look at the third, and all the way through, and so on. And so, in fact, we could possibly, we'll possibly find, as I said, we might fall into two or three groups. Given that we're all mostly Caucasian, we'd probably fall into only two or three. But if we had a wider spread of people, we would have bigger groups, bigger, there'd be more differences. So you've got these markers, and there's many types, like this, and they're passed from generation to generation. Now, one of the complications if they're on autosomal chromosomes is that they get all mixed up and it's a bit hard to track them, and that makes that a bit more challenging. But if they're in the X the Y chromosome or the mitochondrial DNA, they get passed down unchanged. If there's a mutation, if you had a new mutation, and that's possible, it would get passed down to your sons if you're male and to your grandsons and so on. Okay, or if there was a mutation in your grandfather or your great-grandfather or however far back on the paternal line, they would be passed on. Here's just a sort of a picture. This is a condensed version of it. Really, you've got a genetic. There's one individual here. It's male in this particular case, but it doesn't really matter. It could be a mitochondria, or it could be a female and a mitochondria. One, there's a genetic marker. There's, it starts off here with one mutation. Pardon me, and then you've got three progeny which have that marker, of course, because it's inherited. If it's in, say, the mitochondria, well, let's say the Y chromosome is male, or the mitochondrial is female, and then so on. And then you see that there's some other mutations get introduced as we go. It wouldn't happen quite this quick, but if we imagine that between these there might be hundreds of generations between each one of these points here, you know, between here and here, and a new one gets picked up. And so you come down here and you now get a range of mutations in the DNA which distinguish them. Now, of course, these are identical, they're identical. We've got these six surviving combinations, or they're called haplotypes. It's just the word geneticists use for the groupings, okay, that sort of sit over here, these different ones. And people can be grouped into them because of this thing. So we could sample a population of people and say, which one do you belong to? That's the idea, is which one do you belong to in this particular sense. And this is the idea of what, let's see what happens. I think I'll skip that one, because one of the problems here with these markers, the markers, is you get what's called genetic drift. This is a real phenomenon where, in fact, there's a variety of markers at one point in time, but if you then look at some future time, only one of these markers has actually survived, right? It's in this particular sense. And so everybody is identical. Now, they're not all identical genetically. Again, be careful here. We're talking about the mitochondrial DNA or the Y chromosome DNA, because they're passed down unchanged. They might be, they might be all identical in this sort of thing. So you get this capacity. So if you can imagine, you know, 1,000 generations ago, there's a population of human beings which have a variety of markers like this that might have arisen from their ancestry and so on. It could be that in 1,000 generations' time, in this particular area, if these all lived in a particular area, then in 1,000 generations, in fact, this is the only one that's left. It's not that these never occurred, but it's just that and this is a random process, they can get eliminated. They disappear out of the population. But in another population, then this one might be the one that finishes up all down the bottom. You know, it's the major one. And this is the final bit of information. Then I think we get on to giving you a couple of examples, and hopefully we'll finish. This is important, and this is also controversial, or I won't say controversial, disputed or discussed or disagreed upon. Of course, DNA gets it mutates, Because mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome DNA is passed down unchanged, those mutations accumulate. You know, a new one appears and it gets passed down to the offspring of that particular person and to the grand offspring and the great grand offspring and so on, okay? So, and although the oldest DNA goes back about 60,000, I think now, there's a claim for 60,000 years, the DNA of any individual bears actually the accumulated genetic history of the species. So although you can only trace your ancestors back maybe a couple of hundred years if you're interested in genealogy, family history and so on, maybe a couple of hundred, maybe a bit longer, that sort of thing. The point is your DNA bears your accumulated genetic history going back, you know, probably about 2,000 generations till, in theory, when humans, Homo sapiens, came out of Africa. I think the number of generations roughly for that, and then even before that. So the common ancestor, there's accumulation of a set of random DNA mutations in each branch. This is what the molecular clock is. We get a common ancestor. there was a good picture and I didn't have time to put it in, well, a reasonable picture. You get an accumulation of a unique set of random DNA mutations in each branch. I guess the best way to think about it is maybe your children, if you like, or your parents, and then you're the children. You've got brothers and sisters, you've got siblings. And in a way, of course, from now on in, your lines diverge. You know who your cousins are, okay? You might know who your parents' cousins are. You probably don't know who your grandparents' cousins are, you see, because they've diverged away and families move away from that sort of thing. And so what's really happening, yet all of these people, your grandparents' cousins and so on, they can all go back to a common ancestor another couple of generations back from that. But as they've separated, you've each accumulated individual potential mutations may have arisen, a new mutation might have arisen way back, and so you don't have it, but maybe your parents, descendants of your grandparents' cousins do, sort of thing and so on. So you get this unique set of random mutations on each branch as they go off. Okay? It doesn't happen often, remember? I think it's only once every, well, it's hundreds of generations before they actually happen. It's not as if it happens frequently. But and if we assume, and this is the big if, and this is what's disputed, if we assume the mutations accumulate at a constant rate, it's debated, and it differs between autosomal Y and mitochondrial DNA, and people have even debated it differed in time. You know, in the past it was either faster or slower than it is now. This is really quite contentious and difficult. But if we make an assumption here, then the number of mutations will be proportional to the length of time the two groups have been separated. Now, for your great-grandparents and that, that's not very long, and so there's unlikely to be any difference between you and them. But in theory, if you could go back further and look at them, there would be some. Now, a time scale is attached to this by linking an event that has been independently established by other means, such as anatomical, anthropological, or geochronological data, and so on, okay? That's assuming that data is all right too, of course, and that can be disputed as well. And so human and chimps are, you know, on the basis of this sort of anatomical stuff, are thought to be 5 to 6 million years ago. So if we look at chimp mitochondrial DNA and human mitochondrial DNA, Y chromosome DNA, and we look at enough chimps and enough humans, you can sort of look at the mutations and come up with averages, and you can sort of trace back and say, look, there's X hundred mutations between us and them, and that took between 5 and 6 million years. So you can then say, right, well, let's assume mitochondrial DNA mutates at that rate and Y chromosome mutates at this rate, and we can look at our ancestors in that sort of sense. Okay, so what I'm going to do now, I'm just going to look at some examples, the application of this, with some examples of this sort of thing, and then I want to just finish up with, I'll introduce a slightly mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam. And I suppose the question then comes back to is there any relationship between biblical Eve and biblical Adam with that sort of thing, with that at the end. And that's that's the only sort of biblical bit I'll do, because it doesn't lend itself to biblical stuff. I don't want to go into debates about what Genesis 1 and 2 mean in terms of human origins and time. At least the physical side of it. There's a theological side to it, of course. But we'll see. There might be something for questions. Okay, so the first thing is, where did Homo sapiens arrive? There's two hypotheses here. The multi-regional continuity, the African emergence model. That is, I think this picture shows it fairly well. The multi-regional continuity is that what's happened, we got Homo erectus, which moved out of Africa, and these were the first organisms that moved out a million years ago or something like that. Is it, Michael? Okay, I'm not sure. Whenever it was thought from fossil data, Homo erectus moved out into Asia and stayed in Africa, of course, and in Europe. And then what the multi-regional people say, of course, is that even though these are isolated geographically, there was enough gene flow across geographical regions that, in a sense, there was no uniqueness developed. And so you've got Homo sapiens at the end, sort of almost independently evolving, or not independently evolving, because they're not that's the whole basis of it, is that there's interbreeding over the time scale of this. So Homo erectus evolved into modern humans in Asia, Africa and Europe, sort of, because there's now, we don't have any way of proving that, of course, and these are vast distances for humans to have moved, or Homo erectus to have moved, to keep up an interbreeding population, and so on. The other one, of course, is out of Africa. Homo erectus came out of Africa and populated these areas. The fossil evidence suggests that from the fossils. But Homo sapiens then came out, probably out of Homo erectus, maybe by way of Hardalobergensis, I think, is it, and that sort of thing, with this. And a second movement out of Africa occurred into the rest of the world. And also they stayed in Africa. It wasn't as if Homo sapiens all got out of Africa. It doesn't propose that. It says a subset of them went out of Africa and the rest stayed in Africa. But in fact, and these are modern humans, and because this was actually only 200,000 years ago, that's the prediction, or that's the calculation, that's how long we've been around, only 200,000 years, of course, there hasn't been a chance to. Although we've developed phenotypic differences in different areas of the world, and we have what people call race, which is, perhaps, again, not a good word genetically, but there are differences between humans phenotypically, but of course we're all still one species, if you define a species as an interbreeding group of organisms. So this is the out of Africa one sort of thing here. Now the question then becomes, if we look at the DNA of people around the world, mitochondrial or Y DNA, and we sequence it and we see their relatedness to one another, does it support one model or the other? I'm not sure whether. Yeah. Where did Homo arise? Africa appears to be, and there's no human fossils older than. The DNA data takes all of us back, if we do the sequencing and we do the comparisons and we apply the clock, takes all of us back to mitochondrial Eve about 150,000 years ago in East Africa. Every living human is descendant. Now, she wasn't the only human being left on the world. This is one of the things you've got to sort of try and understand, and which I grapple with. When we say you go all the way back to mitochondrial Eve, what it means is that all the mitochondria we have, you can hypothetically say, has come from this single individual. But she wasn't necessarily the only female living. It's just because of genetic drift, it is her line that has permeated down through to the modern day. And the other females who were alive at that time, their mitochondrial DNA didn't survive. Their nuclear DNA, their chromosomal DNA may have, that we can't tell. Doesn't tell us that. Doesn't say that we're all descended from this one woman. It says our mitochondrial DNA is descended from this one woman, but not necessarily our... We can't answer that question, you see. So it's not saying that, you know... So it's not really... I mean, Eve, of course, is very catchy because of its biblical and Christian associations and so on. Although, you're that sort of thing. But if you do that in East Africa, if you do it for the Y chromosome, it comes to 70,000 years ago in East Africa. Well, it was a bit embarrassing then from a biblical point of view. They have a bit different in time with this sort of thing. But all of the Y chromosomes in the world have all come from this one individual. And it's genuinely one individual. For that. But there are other men around. Now, of course, what really happened is that these people were in Africa and they spread out in Africa as well. And then their descendants, probably 60,000 years ago, were a small group of people who moved out of Africa and made up all of the rest of the people who are non-African, right, in that particular sense. So all the people who, you know, who are non-African can trace, only really go back to a small subset of the descendants of mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam. But what the evidence really says is that Homo sapiens arose in Africa. It's not a multi-regional model. The DNA data suggests that, okay, and we didn't have sort of Homo erectus evolving directly all over the world, or at least all over the world apart from Americas, in that way. Okay, just a couple of examples, sorry. The puzzle of the Pacific, population movements in Polynesia. Here's the hypothesis. Was it west to east, from here across the Pacific, or was it from east to west, from South America, across into the Pacific? The Pacific region, particularly out here, Oceania and this area here, was the last area to be populated by humans, okay? Really, and New Zealand, perhaps, you know, only 1,000, 1,300 years ago, or something like that, with the Polynesians and so on. So this was fairly recent. So well after humans were in this part of the world and also in North and South America, in that sort of sense. So, of course, you know, there are lots of reasons. Archaeology, language and domestic animals and plants suggested it was actually from west to east. Okay, that's what it suggested there, except, you know, not everybody accepted that. And in particular, Thor Heyerdahl, those of you who are older, well, not quite old enough, I'm not sure, it happened in 1947. I was pretty little then. Some of you might have been a little bit older, but of course, he was a Norwegian anthropologist who hypothesized it was from, came from South America, and he built a raft, the Contiki, a balsa wood raft, and he sailed it from Peru right across the Pacific and landed in, I'm not sure where he landed over here on the Pacific Islands, you know, actually demonstrating hypothetically that you might be able to do it to support his idea that that's how it happened, okay, in that way. Most of the previous evidence suggested goes from west to east. There is one, it's interesting, from the plants and the animals and so on, the domesticated plants and animals, but there's one plant which is found throughout the Pacific, which is South American. So it's really intriguing, and that's the sweet potato. The sweet potato was native of South America, yet when Europeans got here, it was being well cultivated. How did it get there? Maybe at least one person or one small group made that trip and did they therefore populate the whole area? Well, the DNA data, particularly the mitochondrial, and that this guy talks about it Brian Sykes talks about it in that book. The mitochondrial data very clearly shows that the immigration is from west to east. If you look at the mitochondrial sequences and the mutations, you've got more mutations in this region and fewer mutations as you go further east, which is suggestive of a more recent population movement, more recent separation of peoples from where they might have originated. The question of where they originated from, possibly Taiwan. He suggests Taiwan. Yep, up here. With that, presumably down through here somewhere like this, perhaps. However, I was reading a recent paper that suggests, not by looking at humans, but by looking at fossil domestic animals that the Polynesians used and their current domestic animals, looking at their DNA and looking at their migration patterns. And it's interesting, they've come up with, well, maybe it wasn't up in Taiwan, but actually was in Vietnam. Because the domestic pig, the domesticated pig through Southeast Asia, is very closely related to the wild boar of Vietnam. So it's not just humans you can use. There's a whole swag of evidence people put together to try and draw conclusions with these things. Here's another interesting one. Neanderthal man, we've all heard of that, I guess, at some stage in high school, in history or something. You know, very successful in Europe, particularly Ice Age Europe, and they're physically much stockier build and all those sorts of things. There's been Neanderthals, say, probably 200,000 to 20,000 years ago. The first fossil was in the Neander Valley in Germany, and from their what we know of them, what can be, you know, pardon me, can be derived from archaeological sites and so on. They appeared to have been more reasonably culturally advanced, and they used stone tools, and a big cultural change. They buried their dead, which actually means there's quite an abundance of Neanderthal fossils. Now, it turns out there's a bit of Neanderthal DNA. And then the other question is, of course, if they were already in Europe when when Homo sapiens arrived, and the intriguing question is, of course, what happened to the Neanderthals? They certainly seem to have disappeared about 20,000 years ago. Probably the last group was down in Spain, possibly where they pushed. Did we kill them? Were they, you know, genocide? Or, of course, did we assimilate them? Was there interbreeding with them and so on? You know, now we've got some Neanderthal DNA. You look at it, and you look at human DNA, our Homo sapiens DNA, is there any evidence, particularly in European people, that there was interbreeding? Because they certainly probably coexisted. They probably looked at one another, I guess, you know, at some stage and that sort of thing. So the question is, were they supplanted or assimilated by modern humans? We can't know, except for DNA stuff. The DNA stuff says no. There was no interbreeding. Sorry, I should qualify that. There has been no exchange in the sense of mitochondrial DNA. This is human, modern human DNA here in this particular grouping here, and this is looking at pairwise nucleotide comparison. This is taking a piece of DNA, the same piece of DNA, and comparing the differences across every one of the 450 bases or whatever part of, I'm not sure what part of the sequence they did. You're looking at pairwise comparisons, and this is the spread in humans. So we, modern humans, we don't differ from one another by very much. You know, less than 100 differences in this piece of DNA. Here is Neanderthal. This is human Neanderthal. There's a significant difference in their mitochondrial DNA and ours. If you do a pairwise match, and this is now, we're up to 18 individuals have been sequenced. Now, it's not a big population compared to thousands of humans. As it were, I think there's about nearly 1,000 humans in this one. But there's no overlap here. It would appear that if there was any intermingling in that sort of sense, certainly no mitochondrial DNA from Neanderthal got into the human population, as far as we can tell. And just to show you really how different it all is, this is chimpanzees out here. This is the differences between us and chimps. Huge number of differences, you know, out here. What this really means is that the lineage of chimps is 5 million years old. Chimps were chimps 5 million years ago, and they were chimps, they're still chimps today, chimpanzees today. 5 million years ago, we were, we weren't even Australopithecus. We were well before that, long time before Homo sapiens arrived on the scene. So the thing is there, now, it doesn't rule out, it doesn't prove the absence of a mixture of autosomal DNA. Okay, one can't say that it didn't really happen, of course. But it didn't happen at the mitochondrial level. I don't think they've done the Y chromosome yet. But looking at the differences here from their mitochondria, not so much the difference between them and us, but just looking at the number of differences and putting the clock on it, you get a separation of the divergence of about 600, you know, nearly, well, half a million years, which puts Neanderthal back into coming out of potentially Homo erectus or something like that, quite an independent origin to modern humans. Now I'm just going to dazzle you with simply saying, okay guys, these guys, sort of watch the time, right, we're nearly done, Peter, just these guys have, what's happening now is that people, of course, are just sampling the Y DNA and the mitochondrial DNA of indigenous population groups around the world. Okay, you've got to be careful there. You've got to use as much as you can indigenous population groups because, and this is, you'll see here, this is, I think, before 1500 AD. you know, that sort of thing, because you're trying to get, because beginning around those time with European expansion and so on, you really do start getting a mixture of the DNA from these sorts of things, and the slave trade to the Americas and to the Caribbean and all those sorts of things. But if you can do these sort of pictures, right, and you get these various haplotypes, and the point I want you to see here is that the differences. The Africans are different to the Americans, the Europeans are different here, and the Central Asians and so on are different here. And these reflect differences in the number of mutations. And you can put a time clock on that, and that's how they come up with the migration. Leave it there, with that sort of thing. If you look at Europe, you'll see the overwhelming majority of, in Western Europe, of this orange colour. And most males, a large percentage of males belong to this group here. And then it's much less in Eastern Europe, and there's a predominance of a different haplogroup and so on here. And then down in North Africa, it's different yet again. So these are, and now what people do from this, knowing the number of mutation differences and putting a clock on it, is that they put migration routes on this and migration times. So you finish up with, we won't worry about that, you finish up with these sort of migration patterns and how long ago. Out of Africa, 50,000-60,000 years ago, and they migrate out all over the world. Interestingly, is that probably the first successful really one is this one down here into Australia. It's 50,000 years. Very quickly, probably within a few thousand years, the Aboriginal ancestors had come out of Africa and were in Australia. Australia, the Aboriginal are one of the oldest, apart from Africans, the oldest indigenous populations in the world. So you get these sort of migrations there. They're a bit woolly, you know, and all that sort of thing. You do the same thing for mitochondrial DNA, the female sort of thing, and again you can see the differences in the different parts of the world and so on. And that, I guess you can look at these in a bit more detail there. Here's the seven daughters of Eve, which is really focused on Europe and Western Asia, Eurasia, of course, there. This is their groupings here. These are the groupings of the seven daughters. This particular woman here, or this one here, actually, this is Xenia, this is the seven daughters. At this point here, up here, all modern Europeans are descendant from this point there, in that particular grouping there. With that, but this, the book talks about these, and they lived lots of different times ago. The longest was 45,000 years, and the youngest was 10,000 years. So that sort of thing. This is the world one. This is Africa, the hexagons Africa. Here is the out of Africa person, probably here. This one here, Africa and West Eurasia, probably here, and then all of the non African people have come off from this. These are all of these here. This is over here, Xenia. This is where the Europeans came. Some of these will be Western Asian, American, Eastern Asian and American and so on. And then here's our mitochondrial Eve, 150,000 years ago, possibly coming from Homo erectus. Then in Africa for you know, 60 or 70,000, 100,000 years in Africa. And then a small subgroup move out. The estimate is 2,000 individuals, that's all, went out. So it's just a small group of it. And then you get the mitochondrial DNA migration. I think this is the last one. And of course, this is the paper, 2002, this was in response to this book, probably, around the same time, of course. It caused a big sensation, all this sort of thing, you know. Was it the biblical Eve and that sort of thing? And of course, the time scale, at least based on this data, suggests that, you know, it certainly suggests it was a long time ago. It's not saying that it's not biblical Eve. And of course, the question really here is an interpretation of what is Genesis 1 and 2 trying to tell us about human origins, or at least not even 1 and 2, but Genesis 1 to 11, until the start of Abraham, with this sort of thing. What this does tell us, of course, in a sense that's part of the Genesis story, is that we do, humans, most modern humans, all modern humans, come from a very small group of people. That mitochondrial Eve, well, those used in Africa, it's been estimated that the number of Homo sapiens, as it were, who were there, was possibly no more than 10,000 people, in a sense, that were part of a group living in this area, or maybe less, you know. And then a group of them, as I said, not a subgroup, they had expanded probably by then to move out in Africa. Okay, I must finish there. I'm sorry it's gone a bit long. We did start a bit late, but thank you for your attention. Okay. Thank you.